Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Bob's Red Mill believes in baking, breakfast, and the pursuit of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Today's program has been brought to you by Calavita. Think outside the bottle with Calavita, America's trusted family brand, makers of extra virgin olive oil and fine Italian food products. Calavita.com.
Welcome back to Food Talk. Mike Lomeco here. We've got a great show today. I've got the whole show is wine, so I'm going to give you, in the interest of full disclosure, if you're not interested in wine, bye-bye. But if you are, stay tuned. We've got four guests. We're going to do them in twos. The topic is going to be, as it was for last week's show, Long Island, an area that I know very little about, but the wines are great, and I'm drinking them. So before we get started with my guests, I just want to give a big shout-out to people at Sushi Nakazawa. We were there this week again. If you don't know the place, it's the guy from Jiro Dreams of Sushi. He's the guy that made his egg custard, and Jiro said it was good, and he cried. He's cool. He was Jiro's assistant for many, many, many years. And Alessandro Bourguignon, who's a restaurateur from the Bronx, somehow got a hold of the guy from Facebook and somehow tapped him, got him to open up a restaurant in New York. The rest is history. 4 stars from the New York Times. It's unbelievable. If you want a reference point, I mean, we have great. I'm not going to say 15 East isn't great or Masa and other. There's certainly other options, but all they do is sushi. So there's no cooking. There's no sashimi. There's no tempura. Just one thing. Sushi. That's it. And it is astonishing. It's like a game-changing experience. If you spend $150, you can sit at the bar where he actually serves you directly for $30. That's $120. You sit in the dining room. You eat the same food. Wine list is amazing. We were there the other night. We just drank champagne because the Somme just got back from champagne. So, I mean, champagne and sushi, kind of hard to go wrong. Yeah, so it was sick. And I want to give a huge shout-out to PJ Calapa. He's a chef friend of mine. He came up through Michael White Altamirea Group. I first met him when he was at Mireia, then he opened iFury, then he opened Costada Downtown, then he was at the Bedford Post Inn, so he's been with Michael White for years. Finally branched out on his own, he teamed up with those two Irish brothers that own Bua and, oh, they own a bunch. They've got 6 or 7 different, like, cool bars with cool food programs. Wilfie and Nell's is another one. This took over a space on West 4th. It's called The Spaniard. I forget why they called it that. They told me last night, but it's kind of one of those nights. But the food's unbelievable. So it's a brand new spot. They nailed it from the get-go because they've been doing this for, I guess, about 10 or 12 years now. I had this thing called a patty melt, which patty melt, like in the old days, was like a little skinny hamburger on white bread or something like that. But they're using dry-aged Lafreda meat on really good pain de mie that they bake. It's just, it was like, I think it was $18, and it was probably the greatest $18 I've ever spent in my life. It's just unbelievable. The Spaniard, great restaurant. All right, today's show. First two guests. Here's the theme. Drum roll. Somebody wrote this for me. From Sound to Sea, Long Island Terroir. How's that sound? Sounds like a commercial. All right, so my guests are Miguel Martin, winemaker of Palmer. Bingo. And Anthony Napa, appropriately named, of Anthony Napa / Raphael, two different labels, both on Long Island. Guys, welcome to Food Talk. Thanks for coming out here today.
Thanks for having us.
So can I start with you, Miguel? Tell me, I always love to get backstories on people. What drew you to the world of winemaking?
Well, funny that you said the Spaniard, as you, the best place to have a hamburger and from Spain. And I came to Long Island about 25 years ago, with the intention to spend just briefly a month. And after 2 weeks, I ran out of money. And I said, gee, you know, I better, if I had to spend another 2 weeks here, I better manage to start getting a job. And so I found a job in a winery called Le Ref, which is still, well, it's still there. It changed the name. Now it's called Dog Walk. And they hired me as a winemaker. And so they were so desperate to find a winemaker.
So, but you were a winemaker in Spain?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What part? Where?
I was born in south in Cordoba, in Andalusia, but I grew up in Madrid. So I have my degree as agriculture engineer, and I have a couple of harvests in Spain. So I knew more or less what to do. So they gave me a chance, and I stayed there for a couple of years as a winemaker, and transitioned to go to UC Davis to get my master's there. So after a couple of years in Le Ref, I moved to California. I got my master's at UC Davis and traveled all around the world, Australia, Chile, California, Spain. And about 11 years, well, my wife is from Southampton, and she keep bugging me like, well, it will be so wonderful to go back to Long Island. You know, I miss my sisters. You know, it will be so wonderful to be so close to them. And sure enough, one day we were summering here with them, and I saw that Palmer Vineyards were looking for a winemaker.
How was it, like an ad in the paper, Craigslist?
Well,
a sign on a post?
No, actually, my sister-in-law found that job for me because they were so desperate to have us coming back to Long Island. He said, "Well, Miguel, do you know Palmer Vineyards?"
They were doing. I got so yep. the wife's sisters yes. were doing due diligence.
That's right.
Anybody so, hears of anything, let us know.
And crazy enough, it was a Friday afternoon. I sent my resume, and I was flying back to Spain because at the time we were living in Madrid. So I sent my resume and said, all right, fine, I'll send my resume. And so the next day I flew back to Spain and I got an email from Bob Palmer and say, hey, I would like to interview you for the job. And I said, that's great. I just landed to Madrid. And I said, well, if you want to fly back, I'll pay you for the airfare and I'll interview you for the job. So I was in Madrid less than 24 hours. I don't think I even showered. So I went from the airport to my house and went back to the airport.
Packed and went back again.
That's right. So I was back in New York in less than 24 hours. And so I went, met Bob, we chat. And he said, of the five people I interview, I think you are the best candidate. So if you want, you know, you can be the next winemaker for Palmer Vineyards.
And where is Palmer Vineyards? Remind me again.
Palmer Vineyards is one of the oldest wineries in Long Island, established by Bob Palmer in 1983. And is in the town of Akebok. In Sound Avenue, and so is one of the first wineries as you drive east.
And what was it before he purchased the land? Was it like farmland? Because that seems to be what a lot of it was out there, potato farms or just some sort of farm.
Yeah, that's right. It was a whole potato field, and he was one of the pioneers in the wine industry in Long Island. So he decided to plant a vineyard and become an winery owner.
And 83, so that's how, I mean, it seems like a long time ago.
Well,
I mean, not that long. It's not that late in the history. You know, when you travel the wine world and you go to Alsace and meet the families that are there, you know, the 17th generation of the Trumbachs or the Ugels, you know, it's like, oh, you know, that's sort of in Europe, it's like going back centuries. In America, it's like,
well, but everything,
30 years.
Yeah, but everything is here. Like, if you're lucky, you had two or third generations, you know.
Yeah.
You know, while you say in Europe, you're like a fifth, sixth, seventh generation, or my father had been growing grapes since 1642.
That's
know.
What I mean. Anthony, tell me your backstory. I want to hear about it, please.
Yes, I'm from Boston originally, and I went to UMass Amherst Stockbridge School of Agriculture, so I studied agriculture, and that's how I got into...
That's fun. So what drew you to agriculture?
I didn't want to work in an office. I wanted to be outside. I mean, ironically, I live underground now, and I'm sitting in front of a desk most of the time. But yeah, I really liked science. I really liked botany. I really liked you know, plants, and I liked working outside, working with my hands. And then I went back to school. I went to New Zealand, Lincoln University in Christchurch. And I got a degree. I was going back to school for viticulture specifically. there's no money in agriculture, so I was getting more focused on that. And then I got there, I also did a degree in enology, and then that's how I got into the winemaking side of things.
And how long have you been in Long Island?
I came 10 years. I came in 2007. After I left New Zealand, I went
as a winemaker or as assistant?
As a winemaker, yeah.
Okay.
I worked at a number of places. I went to Italy after New Zealand. I worked there for a while. I went to California, came back, and I wanted to be on the East Coast. So I started at 2007. I started my own brand, Anthony Napa Wines, and I took a winemaking job at Shin Vineyards right when they were building the winery.
So you were talking about them before. So yeah. Rumor has it they just sold.
They did, yeah.
Oh, well. Well, they're good guys, though. I like them. Husband and
wife.
Yeah,
like, yep.
They had a great restaurant for years on Cornelia. Then they went out to do the wine thing. And I guess at some point, if someone throws enough money at you, you say, all right, what the hell?
Yep, but Patrick's making wine there now, and the vineyard's still there, so the wines are still good. So everything's good.
So just, we had some guests last week, and I had the same question. And it answers itself, because you are, in terms of longitude and latitude, your growing regions similar in Europe to Bordeaux, is that correct?
Not really.
That's what someone said last week, so you correct me.
We're at like the 41st parallel right here.
So you'd be where?
It's like Rome, Madrid.
So south of Bordeaux.
Pretty far south, but you can't really look at it that way. I mean, like,
it's completely different.
Yeah,
the ocean temperature, the wind around, I mean, everything's.
If we were in New Zealand, you were like, New Zealand's at the 45th parallel, and Bordeaux's at the 45th parallel.
There's zero comment.
Yeah,
but the reason that I was trying to figure out why the varietals planted in Long Island are almost all Bordeaux varietals. That was why I was curious. So you have Sauvignon Blanc, which kind of its birthplace was Bordeaux and Loire. You have Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc. Again, all in Chardonnay. So we're looking at varietals, with the exception of Chardonnay, that are the typical. Why do you think that is? Those were just in the American marketplace as Long Island was coming up. Those would have been logical things to plant.
I think so. That's part of it. And part of it is that, let's talk about reds first, like Merlot, Bordeaux reds. It's a cool climate, and there's not that many cool climate, very specific places. So
but you're going to get ripe fruit.
Right. And we can do cool climate reds really well. And it's not like we're planting a Yanico or Nero de Avila or Spanish varieties. Those varieties would never ripen. So and even though they stumbled upon it in a roundabout way, right, it actually works out pretty well because some of the warmer varieties in the West Coast wouldn't necessarily ripen consistently here, but cooler climate, Pinot Noir can ripen here. And
is anybody planting Pinot Noir?
Yeah, there's a bit of it planted, yeah. A lot of it goes to sparkling, of course, but...
But to give you an idea, there's about 3,000 acres of grapes planted in Long Island. A third is Chardonnay and a third is Merlot.
So two-thirds of the production are those two grape varietals.
Yeah, and the rest of the grapes, Sauvignon Blanc, Riesling, Cabernet Franc, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, and so forth. But those two grapes are very important for a region. And pretty much every winery in Long Island, they produce Chardonnay and Merlot. I mean, they'll produce other wines, but at least they have those two in their portfolio.
So I had a bottle of your Chardonnay sent down to my house in Cape May. I had no idea what to expect. I don't really like reading tasting notes or anything before I taste wine. I sort of like to discover the bottle as if you're trying to get to know someone, without reading the resume first. Like, who is this person? Who is this human being? And really, really delicious wine. Really great. So talk to me about when you harvest, about what you're looking for ripeness, because it just seemed to be real focused, real clean, real linear. I got zero oak. Maybe I'm missing it. Maybe it's large format, but it seems stainless all the way to me. It's a real great expression of the fruit, and just that's a super clean, crisp expression of Chardonnay. It wasn't chubby and round and overripe, and again, I'm not, I think, after, at my age, having grown up in the 90s, right, if I see one more bottle of, international style oak Chardonnay, I'm going to shoot myself. And I was just in Sicily last year at Planeta, and they're like, oh, here, try our Chardonnay, and I'm like, I don't think the last thing we needed in the world was another, Burgundian or
Sicilian Chardonnay.
Yeah, in Sicily, you have so many grapes, let's do what you do. But anyway, so talk to me about that wine and what you're aiming for in making it.
Yeah, well, that's the 2016 Chardonnay is 100% tank fermented, no oak, no barrels. And I agree with you. I mean, I think the tendency now, at least what I've seen is the people are looking for more wines with expression of the terroir or the area. They want more of the varietal component in the wine. If they want to have Sauvignon Blanc, they want to taste Sauvignon Blanc. If they want to taste Chardonnay, they want to have a clean, crisp, good fruit, well-balanced, good acidity, and good finish wine. I used very, very little oak in my wines. I use a little bit of oak in the red wines, but all my whites are made in stainless steel because I think they are very food friendly. The tendency is shifting. Like you were saying, probably 10, 15 years ago, everybody was loving oaky Chardonnays. And the more oak, the better. And if you feel like you are licking a 2x4 when you taste the wine, that's even better because it shows that you have money and you can money to spend buying very expensive French barrels. Consequently, you charge $45 for a bottle of Chardonnay because somehow you had to justify all those expensive barrels.
Right.
But, you know, my style and the style of the grapes that we go in Long Island, definitely we will never have wines with 15% alcohol. Then they perhaps they can handle better the oak or wines. They will get around 13.5, which is plenty of alcohol on the wines, and they will be more balanced. They will be wines that are more food friendly and more enjoyable. And so that's what I'm hoping on the wines.
So either of you can jump on this, but I think as wine makers, because you're, I mean, at the end of the day, you have to sell the wine, right? So last week we were saying that I remember when Kermit Lynch and Neil Rosenthal and some of the early guys back in the late 80s and 90s were coming to restaurants with their early portfolios from Europe. A lot of the wines were really high acids, linear, precise wines, and we love them as chefs, and our somms would love them, and our front of the house would love them, but then the blowback was always going to be, I can't sell these. Mm. Because the American customer in the 80s and 90s, to your point, had a palate that was really so used to California. Oh, I don't want to say overripe, because it's super ripe, super fruit, super berry. I mean, kind of the cliche Merlot of just these super soft, fruit-forward wines that were just fruit bombs, and the alcohol was high. And with Cabernet Sauvignon, it was often oaked in American oak, and the Chardonnays were American oaked again. So that was sort of the, and now, again, to your point, I think in the last 15 or 16 years, the palate, at least in New York and the big cities, the palate's really moved towards wanting acidity. Because what works with food? What works with food is, you know, minerality and acid and leanness kind of complements it. So
yeah, I mean, our wines are all very food friendly, and that's part of what we have going for us. And we do have moderate alcohol levels, and sometimes they're even lower. Sometimes they're at 11-12%. I mean, depends on the varietal and the vintage. We have huge vintage variation, but to your point, I think what works well for us is these very food friendly, acidic, acid driven, structured summer. Summer wines that we sell, you have to remember, our customer base isn't necessarily the broader American palate. I mean, we sell a very high percentage of our wines
locally,
seasonally,
right.
Locally.
Yeah.
So people are drinking them in the summer. They're drinking them with seafood. We make a lot of reserve wines that are made in a more of a Bordeaux style, but we make, at Raphael and for myself, we make a lot of we call them at the estate level wines, where the red wines that are unoaked, like this Cabernet Franco here, because that style is perfect for summer. It's perfect for food. You can have a slightly chilled, like in Italy, like in the Piazza. You can have it with pizza, pasta, very food friendly wines. And, you can have it with fish even. We like untraditional pairings, and we have a real strong food economy where we are. A lot of farmers, different vegetables, animals, a lot of seafood.
And you're surrounded by water.
We're surrounded by water.
Yeah, you got great ports, great seafood in Long Island. And now really nice. I mean, it's sort of like that's a perfect farm-to-table spot to be in, too.
Definitely.
I remember years ago I used to work with Eberhard Mueller when he was a chef before he went out and opened Satter Farms, and now they're killing it out there. Mm. But, you know, sort of went from the kitchen to farming, and I'm like, dude, what are you doing? But it seemed like the right thing at the right time.
Yeah, definitely.
And taking care. So I'm drinking your... Tell me about the Old Roots Merlot. Old meaning these are some of the older vines you have?
Yes, I do. Bob Palmer planted the grapes, and he planted Chardonnay and Merlot, among other things, in 1983. So there's a block of Merlot that it produced very little. The vines are older, all the oldest vines that we have in the vineyard. And we drop a lot of fruit in order to concentrate most of the aromatics and the flavors. And I love the fruit coming that from that particular block. And one day I told Bob, and said, Bob, this fruit is really, really beautiful. We should try to make a wine out of this.
Just that, like a single parcel.
Right.
And the soil type would be loamy, sandy, a little bit of clay?
Yeah, well, we are surrounded by water. So obviously it's sandy and very poor. We use some of the we are surrounded by horse farms, so we collect manure. The horse manure, and we make own compost to add more nitrogen and make the soil richer. So I proposed that to Bob and said, why don't we make 100 or 150 cases from this particular block? And I said, all right, well, if you think it's gonna do well, I said, well, let's try. And so he said, let's keep this block separate, let's ferment it separate and see what kind of wine we have. And I've been very happy with this wine.
It's delicious.
Thank you.
And it's funny because I think Merlot got this that movie that I don't think I've ever seen it, but the one that,
it never happened.
Yeah, and it was just this blowback, and I sort of get it. I mean, to go back to California and that sort of 90s style of Merlot that was plummy, low acid, super velvety, blah, blah, blah. But then I think of, I travel a lot in Europe, and I think of, Merlot and in Bordeaux and, on Clay Soil and Saint-Emilion and or Pomerol with Chateau Ozone and Cheval Blanc. I mean, all these, and there's like this incredible expression of that grape. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just one of these great grapes on planet Earth. So how it got bashed is like, anyone that like rolls their eyes, I'm like, shut up. It's a great grape. Just it's one of the great grape varieties on planet Earth. Don't you're reading it into it.
It's amazing how much power the media has, and how much influence the people. It only takes a movie or one credit to say then the next best thing to drink is Pinot Grigio, and everybody's drinking Pinot Grigio.
Well, and I think for a long time, back to that sort of California style of American ripe fruit and oak, that Parker was. He had a palate, but you couldn't make a wine too big for Parker, it seemed like. The higher the alcohol, the more extraction you had, the more fruit you had, the firm tannin. I was like, that's what was getting 97, 98. And people were making wines for him. I mean, he had this hegemonic effect on the industry that we're kind of recovering from, I think. Like, wake up with a hangover, like, why are we drinking this shit? This isn't what we like. Not even Parker's sort of, still doing what he does. All right, so what did I pour here? I've got your Sauvignon Blanc.
Sauvignon Blanc from Raphael. Yeah.
So, Raphael, to distinguish the labels for me. So, you have two labels. You have Raphael and Anthony Napa.
I have my own brand. When I came to Long Island, I started my own brand. So, we do about maybe 1,500 cases of our own wine. And I do a lot of small lots, play with a lot of different stuff. Makes it fun for me. But Raphael is a bigger place. We do between 12,000 and 15,000 cases. We're very heavy on Sauvignon Blanc, Cab Franc. And we do things a little more straightforward in a way sometimes. We have a whole line of reserve red wines, but we make a lot of red wines that are I like to say Long Island style, trying to invent our own thing. I think Sauvignon Blanc, this is a couple years old, so I like older white wines. It's kind of fun to bring something a little different.
14, gotcha. I usually don't think of Sauvignon Blanc as aging.
It ages beautifully.
It's funny.
This Sauvignon Blanc is a reserve Sauvignon Blanc, so it has 15% Semillon in the Semillon portion.
I was going to ask that question. So it's not on the label. So it's kind of in that Bordeaux, so you're getting a little more weight, a little roundness,
right.
A little more
oiliness. And the Semillon portion is skin fermented like an orange wine.
Gotcha.
So it's even accentuates that even more. And it just has like real fleshiness, like a real structure to it. I love structured white wines. And obviously it's Sauvignon Blanc, tons of acidity, but the acidity kind of softens out after a couple years in the bottle. I love aged white wines. It's always a shame when March comes around and everyone's like, we want your new vintage. It's a year in a bottle can do a lot, 2 years in a bottle.
And this is stainless the whole way.
Yeah.
Everything. So it's nothing. So no oak, no blend, not 10% blend, nothing.
Just the Semillon portion, which is skin fermented.
Okay, which is skin fermented.
But
how long on skin?
Probably 2 weeks.
Through the fermentation?
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
And then just batonnage?
No.
No, don't need it.
No.
Okay. This is, like, for me, blind tasting, it's Sauvignon Blanc. I mean, you've got it, but it's not that sort of...
It's not New Zealand.
Because you were saying New Zealand, I'm like, oh no, this is going to be super Sincere. Gooseberry catfish.
It's Long Island.
Right.
It's not Sincere.
Right.
We have a very unique expression of Sauvignon Blanc in Long Island. I think it's something that, in the long run, you could easily taste blind. That Long Island Sauvignon Blanc has a real unique expression.
But it's funny. So I don't have that reference point.
Right.
I know zero about Long Island wines. This is like I'm in first grade with you guys. Thanks for coming out today. But I know about the grape, and I drink a shit ton of Loire Valley. So I'm drinking all of your stuff, and I'm not really – I'm in the old world. I mean, I'm drinking your Merlot, and I'm thinking, yeah, probably Right Bank, Third Growth. I don't know who the producer is. Why would I? I'm drinking this, and again, I could be in Bordeaux, or I could be in the Loire, but I probably lean with Bordeaux on this just a little – Yeah, that's where I would go. I would think I was in Bordeaux. I just wouldn't get... I know I'm not New World. I know I'm not West Coast. And I sure shit know I'm not New Zealand.
Yeah.
So it's like an old world style, but with Long Island terroir.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about this other guy, this antique, whatever you called him. I was confused.
Bordeaux Antico. That's our... my label's Cabernet Franc. We've been making it since 2010. Bordeaux, spelled like that, is an Italian term for Cab Franc. So,
and I didn't know they had Cab Franc
in the north, in like in Friuli and all across the north. There's quite a bit of Cab Franc, but they don't usually label it as varietal. And so, but oftentimes in the north, they'll speak of it as Bordeaux. But so anyway, we make it in that kind of Italian style, no oak, real kind of expressive of Cabernet Franc. We like to say a real authentic kind of Italian style. You can have it with pasta, pizza. This perfect place right here to have it at this restaurant. You can have it slightly chilled in the summer. You can have it with seafood. You can have it with fish. And that's kind of what we're going for overall on Long Island. We're going for real food-friendly, approachable wines. And I like to even emphasize the greenness in Cabernet Franc. People like to be negative about greenness. But
we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, that there was that... I drink a lot of Loire Val Cab Franc, and depending on the year, depending on the vintage, depending on the soil type, will affect that sort of green peppery thing that's going on.
But
how
for,
ripe was the fruit? What was it growing above?
Right.
Was there some slate down there? And I think because in an old way that used to be seen as a fault in Bordeaux for unripeness, that carried over. If I taste that, it's a bad thing. And,
right.
And I'm like, actually, I really like that. it's kind of like a signature of the DNA of Cab Franc is that slightly vegetal in a pleasant way that isn't unripe green. It's
right.
Just, oh, no, that's the grape.
I think in Cab Sauv, it can be more of a fault in a way. But
right,
in Cab Sauv, it comes across as, just like Sauvignon Blanc, fresh-cut grass, eucalyptus, mint. But in Cab Franc, it comes across in a real herbal way: sage, thyme, oregano. And if you think about those herbs, pairing those with your food, it's a perfect combination, especially, you know, Italian food. So if you get some of those herbal notes that aren't grassy but herbal into your wine, into your meal, it's like a perfect.
And I don't know if you talked me into this.
I'll talk you into anything.
No, you did, because I'm drinking this Cab Franc, and I'm saying, yeah, I think blind, I'm on the nose, it's Cab Franc in the mouth. And then suddenly, you're talking, and I'm tasting, and I'm like, Sangiovese? Are we in Italy, or what? There's something else going on here, because there is this sort of like oregano, stewy, tomato-y, something
exactly.
That I'm not getting in Cab Franc from the Loire.
Right. No, it's not Loire, this is Long Island. Long Island Cab Franc, buddy.
That's why you're here.
Yeah.
That's why I'm learning.
No, I mean, I think another perfect example, I think Cabernet Franc has got a great home in New York, and it has a unique expression to the point where you could taste it blind against Loire or other places and say, this is Long Island, this is New York.
These were great. This is really impressive, too. I mean, that's just really delicious, food-friendly wines. Can I ask the retail price for the Sauvignon Blanc?
I think it's like $25.
Cheap.
And the Cab Franc is 22.
Seriously?
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to find this in Manhattan, where would I buy it? Would Astor have it?
I'm not sure. We have a distributor, so I'd have
to go look for it. Delicious. So did I taste everything you brought from Palmer?
Yep.
Okay.
The Chardonnay Merlot. Yep.
Guys, great. I'm looking forward so much to coming out in September with a a crew and
do, we can't
a,
wait.
Do a
great
story with PBS for you guys, because there's nothing.
And the fall is beautiful.
Yeah, drinking, tasting is one thing, but putting a shovel in the soil and smelling the air and seeing where you are in relation to the coast and slopes and it just it's the best way. I mean, it's, you kick the tires, you learn.
Yeah, the harvest is actually the most exciting time of the year. I mean, this is the moment that you have been waiting all year on.
Yeah, you get one chance, yeah. And that's it.
And when the fruit is ripe and you walk through the vineyard tasting the Sauvignon Blanc or the Riesling or the Chardonnay or the Merlot or the Cabernet Franc or whatever grape, and you know, it really is. You know, I've been doing this for so long, but I still get excited every year because, you know, every year you have different challenges. And
what are the first grapes you're going to harvest traditionally? What's going to ripen first?
Well, obviously sparkling will, but we at Raphael, we have some Pinot Grigio as well. So Pinot Grigio, Pinots will always come first, Pinot Noir, Pinot Grigio, and then Sauvignon Blanc comes.
And for the sparklings, you do different, do you pick a little early to get some acid in the way they do in some cultures?
We don't do sparkling, but Jill, okay. you'll be next. Talking about that next.
Yeah. Okay, next. Yeah. Guys, thanks. So much for coming in. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
A quick spot, a commercial break for the people that make this show possible and the other shows on Heritage Radio Network. Stay tuned. I'm going to be back with two more Long Island vignerons and keep this rolling. Stay tuned for that.
Well, she's her own.
I'm Mike Colomeco, host of Food Talk on Heritage Radio Network, and I'm here with Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill, as well as Ray and Tom Williams, who've worked with Bob for years and co-own an organic farm in eastern Oregon and Washington. Ray, Tom, why is organic farming so important to your family?
It's all a matter of the soil is a source of nutrients. You increase organic matter of the soil, you increase the water holding capacity. Water is becoming increasingly scarce. So in terms of sustainability, we don't think it's the only answer, but it's one answer, and it's the answer that we're trying to pursue.
It's been a challenge, and it's been fun because it is different, and we're learning how to do it for the last 10 plus years.
We're not just doing organic, we're doing organic to high standards.
Bob, why did you choose to partner with Ray and Tom?
Oh, goodness. Well, because they're the best farmers in Oregon, and they're close, and they have a bunch of acres, I think about 10,000, over in eastern Oregon and Washington. They're wonderful farmers, and their family have been farmers over there for many, many years.
It's really important that you have long-term relationships, and we've enjoyed a long-term relationship with Bob's because there are a lot of challenges to organic farming. You simply don't have as many tools as a conventional farmer, and so you have to rely on longer-term solutions.
Knowing that you have a market is absolutely critical. The margins in farming are not that great, so if you grow the stuff and you can't sell it, you have a real problem. And we know with Bob's that we have a market, and we turn out high-quality grains, and they buy them, and it all works well.
Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast. Hey, folks, Mike Colomeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Colavita family brand for years, and there really is a Colavita family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Colavita. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Colavita family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Colavita's living in Rome. Colavita's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. Hey, welcome back. Food Talk. Michael Lomeco here. Okay, we're going to segue right in. We have two more guests from Long Island, because that's the theme today. But wait a minute. There's a sub-theme. Hold on. Keep me on point here. So tell me, it's single-style focus vineyards. I'm not sure what that means. Someone's going to tell me what that means. You don't have to tell me what that means. I wrote it down here. So I have two guests. Gilles Martin, who's from Sparkling Point Winery. We're going to taste their version of Bubbles from Long Island done Method Champenoise.
Exactly.
And Alice Schaefer from Croutot, who's brought me some rosés.
Yeah.
So I don't know what single style focus vineyards means, but guys, talk to me about let me get your backstories first. I got with everybody else so I can kind of figure out who you are. Let's start with you.
Yeah.
What got you into wine, Alice?
Well, I started out as an engineer, actually. So I sort of walked backwards into
all these
wine.
Geniuses in winemaking. I started out as an astrophysicist, and I was getting bored at NASA after.
There are a lot of these geeks in the wine business I've found over the years. You know, like, and we find each other and we start talking, you know, like aerospace, and then talk about, you know,
philosophy,
and then viticultural techniques and different kinds of yeasts, and you know, it's like a total nerd out fest. It's great.
Correct. Yeah. But anyway, so you were studying what again?
Yeah. I studied manufacturing engineering in school, and but took up the hobby of wine while I was in school. Go figure.
You mean drinking? Not growing, yeah, not like...
Not growing, but appreciating it, yes.
And where'd you go to school? Where is this
first? At Cornell University, which is up in the Finger Lakes. So that's how
Cornell,
I got my...
I've heard of that. Yeah, it's one of those, like a second tier...
Yeah, you know, sorry.
Part of the SUNY program. It's a good state.
It does have a couple SUNY colleges, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So, all
but
right.
Anyway,
so
yeah,
you are a genius. Okay. So you're Cornell and you're drinking, like, so what wines out there were you... How'd you get exposed to wine?
Well, there's a terrific beverages program through
their
former hotel school.
Drew Niebuhr went there, a lot of guys went
there. Yeah, a lot of folks here in town that have gone through the Cornell program. And they're kind enough to open up an introductory Wines of the World class to us non-hospitality types. And so I took that because I wanted something that was not statistics and formulas and whatnot. And it was an excuse to be happy on a Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah, around alcohol and learning at the same time. So it's the European way.
Sure.
We're not drinking Jaeger bombs. We're wines and studying phenolic content.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it was exactly that. So, and you actually, you know, it was set up as a pass-fail class, but you actually had to do something in order to pass, you know, do something more than to show up. So it appeared in my life as just something that I didn't know that I was going to really enjoy, and over the years developed as a hobby. And then in the second half of my 20s, hit that point where you hit that quarter-life crisis, and you go, what the hell did I go to school for? I don't know. All I knew was, you know, I was working in aerospace, actually, and I wasn't fully happy. I was in a cubicle and in front of a laptop all day, and that's not me. I like to be out and around and doing things and trying different things. And I had returned from California back to New York, and with no particular design in mind, but just happened upon a position at a tasting room in the Hudson Valley, and that started the whole career.
Wow, that's humble beginnings.
And so, yeah, basically, I learned by doing. I never went to school for viticulture or oenology. Everything I've learned on the job from my colleagues. Just get into it, ask questions, experiment.
So were you an assistant winemaker somewhere for a while?
No, I started my own company. So I got into the wine business in 2000 with that first job at a tasting room. Mm. Eventually started taking more classes, segued into becoming a sommelier, worked retail in the city here. Eventually worked with a distributor for a while. So I went through the business. I learned the business side of it. And through that, really developed an appreciation of, you know, what it is that people buy and sell and why. And so in 2006, I founded my own company, my own brand called Brooklyn Oenology. And I still produce those wines to this day. And it's 100% New York fruit, Long Island and Finger Lakes grapes. So I source from all over the state.
How come I've never heard of that? And I should. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know Red Hook Wineries. Mm-hmm. They're doing a similar thing?
They're sourcing fruit from North Fork primarily.
Correct. Yep. A couple of different two guys from California.
Yeah,
have come out.
Yeah. I think they started the winery in 2008. I had started my company in 2006.
So you're ahead of them?
Temporally, yes.
What's that?
Yes. Very respectable winery as well.
Yeah, no, they're really, I was in their tasting room, tasting out of the barrels, and I'm like, holy shit, this is solid.
Yeah, they're doing some wild and crazy stuff over there.
Yeah, and it's really, really good. Mm-hmm, so are you just, again, stupid questions. Yeah. I should know all this stuff. These are yours.
So I did not start Croteau. I was hired as their consulting winemaker for the 2015 harvest. And so these two wines that we brought are from the 2016. So I last year started another company called Ali Shaper Fine Wines. And so I consult under that brand. I do. I also have a brand of wine called As If Wines under that moniker. And I do custom wines for clients, as well as some shops and some restaurants around town and on Long Island. So
their own label.
Yeah. So this is Croteau, Croteau Vineyards in Southhold, and all we make is rosé. That
Why?
Is it.
Why is that?
Well, it was a vision of the owner to create it was a vision to bring a little Provence to New York. And it turns out New York is a really great climate for rosé. And I think we saw an explosion of rosé in New York in one tough vintage that we had. It was 2011. We had Hurricane Irene come through.
Oof.
And it was really hard on the red wine harvest. It was hard on the entire harvest. And so what did people do? They made lemonade out of lemons.
Right.
And so a lot of what was supposed to be red wine ended up becoming rosé. But the Croteaus... specifically had that vision beginning in 2006 with making just rosé. So they planted their vineyard with several different clones of Merlot, with Sauvignon Blanc, and with Cabernet Franc. And out of those wines, we make a rosé out of clone 181 of Merlot, out of clone 314 of Merlot. Then we make a wild indigenous ferment out of clone 181. We also have clone three. This is the Sauvage. Yeah, this is the 181. Or is this 181 or the Sauvage?
It says 181.
Yeah, okay. So that's, yeah. So
I
that's
hope
not
I'm reading
the,
it.
Yeah.
So describe this one more time to me, the process.
Yeah.
So it's in my glass.
Yeah, so this
what
is...
What did you use, native yeasts?
This one is not. No, not, so we do a second crew that is the 181 clone, but with native yeast. So this is used with a particular strain that we selected specifically for bringing out the varietal character of the Merlot 181 clone. And so we're doing an exploration of these very small variables that change in between grapes. So you have these clones with different numbers attached to them. So it's like saying each human being is a slightly different clone from one another. So Homo sapiens, each one is a slightly different clone. We're all essentially the same thing, but you've got brown eyes, I've got blue eyes, right. That kind of thing.
Right.
So slight differences, but we're essentially the same. And so that comes out in these grapes as well.
That's boring down.
Yeah, they're getting boring. Really nerdy about
it. No, that is. Yeah. That's getting there. Now, I'm curious.
Yeah.
Gilles, I'm going to get to you in 1 second. But so I have two bottles in front of me.
Yes.
That are yours. And one's Merlot, the other's...
The other one's Cabernet Franc. Yeah.
And the color's totally different.
Yeah.
So tell me about that decision, skin contact,
how
long the firm... Mm-hmm. Why is the Cab Franc five shades darker than
well,
the
Merlot? Well, there's this... this big concept in that rosé is supposed to be super pale, and that's very much the trend right now because Provence rosé is really, really hot. And granted, that is sort of the birthplace of rosé, if you will. But color and extra skin contact time gives even a more interesting robustness and flavor depth to a wine. So with the Cabernet Franc, I'll start with the Merlot. With the Merlot, we go what's called direct to press. So we pick the grapes a little bit earlier than you would for red wine production to maintain the acidity.
Right, so you've got acid.
Yep.
Right.
And send those grapes right into the press. We don't crush it and then let the skin soak because we want to get a really beautiful pale, pale, pale color out of that. And with that, you also extract out lots of beautiful white fruit notes, things like white raspberry, peaches, nectarines, etc., stone fruit, maybe a little pineapple, depending on what the variety it is. With the Cabernet Franc, though, we approach it very differently. So, again, we pick specifically for making rosé. And with Cabernet Franc, this is a little bit tricky because, as Anthony was mentioning earlier, if it's green and bell peppery, it can be unpleasant. So you kind of have to find that really sweet spot between ripe enough that you're not going to extract that into your rosé, but with not too ripe such that you lose the acidity. So then we crush, let it soak for 6 to 8, sometimes 12 hours, depending on that year. to get extract that more color, to get that depth, and then to crushing. Then go to press.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're totally...
They're wildly different from each other.
Remarkably different wines right. from each other is right. correct, yeah.
Yeah. And that's the beauty of rosé. You know, there's so many different ways you can make it, as many varieties as there are you can make rosé.
And that little extra mm-hmm. skin contact gives you so much more weight.
Yeah.
This wine's just bigger, fatter,
terrific.
Rounder.
You know, I'm a huge proponent of rosé since I became it was a hobby. You know, back in college, I would go to the wine shop and go pick up a bottle of Tavel because that was just my jam. So when Croteau approached me to do winemaking with him, I was like, hell yeah. And, you know, it's a drink that really should and can be enjoyed year round. And the Cabernet Franc is a great example of what I'll call an autumn or winter rosé.
Yeah, it's got weight.
Yeah. And it typically kind of reaches its peak flavor, say, 6 months to a year and a half out from when it's bottled.
Shields, we haven't gotten to you yet. Sorry.
That's
running.
Okay.
Tell me about your background. You are French.
Obviously, I am. I'm sure you can...
I can tell that.
...tell that through the accent, but we're going to try to hide that a little bit today.
Nah.
Or not.
Don't do that.
I've been here a while, so I'm going to try to do my best. Yes, my approach is quite different. I grew up actually on an orchard. My grandparents had pear apples and... all kind of fruit.
In the north?
No, actually at the gate of the Champagne area on the east side of Paris. And so for me, cider was always in the family. We had cider, we distilled, you know, apple brandy, cherry brandy, all kind of different fruit. And I grew up into that atmosphere. But, you know, being near Paris, there's not a lot of grapes. You have to look east and look at Champagne to see the grapes going. Luckily for me, half of my family is from Alsace. So we go even farther east and taste those fantastic Riesling and Gewürz and Silvaner that you know.
Yeah.
But that's not what brought me into wine, actually. I studied in the food industry. Because I like science and I like chemistry and I like a lot of kind of chemistry, I have to say. And after a couple of years, I got a degree in food industry, food chemistry. And my uncle was a winemaker, actually, not by tradition, but by education. And he kind of said to me, well, you know, Gilles, what about doing winemaking? He said, study enology, we call it. And I said, why not? You know, I was at the time working for a big company, General Food, for actually an internship, and I was doing the first sugarless chewing gum in France. Actually, that's my first, you know, background, if I can say that. And then I said, well, yes, I can see that. You know, Montpellier is a beautiful place. There is the sea, there is the mountain, there is the sunshine, there is very pretty ladies down there.
It's a college town.
It's a very nice college town. And you know who went to Montpellier?
No.
Nostradamus.
Holy mackerel.
I didn't do schooling in Montpellier at the same time than him.
I guess not.
But I think I gained a little bit of that vision. When you do a blend, and we're going to jump, and we'll come back. When we do a jump, we have to have that vision of what's blending and so forth. But anyway, from Montpellier, I was not someone who wanted to just work, but I wanted to discover. I had a little bit caught the virus or the bug of traveling. Because my brother at the time was in Africa, and I traveled in Africa, and that stayed with me, discovering new places. And after my studies in Montpellier, I traveled a little bit the world. I went to Germany, I went to Australia, and I came back to France to work as a consultant for 25 wineries in the south of France. And being there...
The south, Languedoc-Roussillon?
In the Camargue area, so okay. The bottom part of the Rhône today, and also the Languedoc part.
Yeah.
And being there, one of my professors said, Gilles, you know, you've been traveling a little bit. I have someone who's looking for somebody in America. Are you interested in America? America? Here we are. You know, we all dream about America when you're born in Europe. And
let's hope that continues.
And hopefully. And it does. And I came my first job in America was in Virginia. So I worked a couple of years in Virginia and discovered the wine industry of the East Coast.
There's actually really good. I used to have a doctor friends, a couple. They were both physicians, and right. they taught and they worked at the University of Virginia. And we went down to visit them. And I remember, I forget the name of the winery now because this was like 30 years ago. But I was drinking some red wines in Virginia that were back then that were just effing good wine.
Absolutely. And whites as well. And from Virginia, I realized that there is a big industry in America that I didn't know too much about, was California. So I contacted a few of my friends, and I got in contact with Roederer, and I worked for Roederer Estate for 6 years.
California.
California.
Yep.
At the same time, we were kind of sharing, you know, a school, if you want, of winemaking with friends. So I did a lot of trips in France with the winemaking team as well. And that's really where I learned with the best of the best how to make sparkling wine and champagne.
Well, you did. So you're just doing sparkling wines.
For sparkling point, I'm also involved with all other wineries.
Okay, but we're here today with those.
But here today, we'll talk about sparkling wine.
So talk about it. So we have two bottles of wine, two bottles of bubbles, and they're done method champenoise, so we should really... I mean, you explained, we'll give them the champagne 101.
The secret with sparkling wine or champagne is in the bottle, as you know. Mm-hmm. It uncovers a little bit that secret this way. And I want you to listen.
Bingo.
One of the best sounds in the world.
So, as you know, this is already time for celebration. Mm-hmm. But the secret of sparkling wine, or method champenoise, should I say, is the second fermentation in the bottle.
Right.
We do base wines that are low alcohol, high acidity wines. We picked a little bit earlier than anybody else. On my end, I want to work with the champagne variety, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier. And Long Island have shown that consistency into the wines and into making a style of a sparkling wine that will be very respectful of what method champenoise is about. Then we referment those wines into the same bottle that you're holding today. And the produce of that second fermentation is a little sediment, a yeast sediment, which is very important because that sediment at the same time gives you an aromatic profile, the brioche, the doughiness, the almond, the roasted almond as well, but also acts as a retainer of the carbon dioxide. And the longer you keep the wine on the yeast, on that sediment, the tinier the bubble becomes.
But the harder it is to make money because you have a vintage that sits for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years on lease. You don't see the money for until the 8th year as a return.
Like in a lot of farming business, you have to be patient.
Is this the French
patient. It's true, but it's beautiful. It's money in the bank. As a matter of fact, I mean, you know that some of the most prestigious Bordeaux chateau made more money than the stock market. So wine is money. Wine is pleasure. Wine is life. Mm-hmm. This is what we share every day.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So the first one that you have is a cuvée called Brut Seduction, because that's what I'm trying to do, is seduce people and with these beautiful wines. It's aged 8 years on that yeast, so it's a 2007, 10 years... It was produced 10 years ago.
So you have somebody in the cellar racking the wine all the time?
As I said, I'm a little more of a technician. So we kind of abandoned that. Why? Because two problems with what we call riddling by hand is that it takes space, it takes time, it takes money. So today we have
a
riddling machine, Jao Pallet it's called. And within a week you riddle 500 bottles at a time. And I have about... 8 of those cages riddling every week.
This is I keep saying this and I feel terrible because I keep my compliment to all of the wines I've had is they're old world wines, and I would not have guessed this was, I don't want to say from Long Island because I have not that much familiarity, but it's just great juice, like serious juice.
Can you
pour me a little bit of that? Because I don't want to pour it in this glass. Thanks so much.
I think it's really important to understand that when you make a wine, you have a vision, and you talk about the fact that those wines stay so long. And you have to have that vision That's why I went into the best place, because Nostradamus was there. And that's why with the vision of creating those special blends that can age that long, it doesn't come overnight. I think it's I owe that to the great education I received through the Roder and the Dutz team.
So you don't have, we're not looking at limestone. We're not looking at Kimmeridgian, whatever the name is for these soil types. You have sand and some clay.
Sand is a great terroir for drainage. Drainage is very important for the vineyards. We have a couple feet of top soil, which is a loamy soil. And what makes a difference between those wines from Long Island and the Champagne area is that the maturity of the grapes is quite different. But you might know that some of the terroir, some of the minerality of the wines are not due only to the terroir itself, but also to all that magic that happened during fermentation. And that's what we try to see here. It's not to make a champagne. I'm not pretending making any champagne. That's not my will. My will is to make a wine that I will appreciate as I appreciate a Grand Champagne. My vision is to make those specific blend that can age 8 years. And after 8 years, or 10-year wine is still as fresh as a young wine of 3 or 4 years with the specific characteristic of that aging.
You're working with Chardonnay, Pinot Meunier, and Pinot Noir?
Right.
Okay, so the Champagne blends.
Right. In this case, it's only Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. Pinot Meunier is not always part of the blend of the higher tête de cuvée, but it is some years, depending on, of course, the ripeness of the fruit at that time.
And do you pick, when you're, because we want acid in this, we want that backbone, we want that freshness in the acid.
Right.
So are we doing a couple of passes, or are we picking the Chardonnay and
no, once? Each vineyard lots or blocks.
When they're ready.
Will be a lot.
Gotcha.
So I have about 40 different tanks in the winery, and each tank has its own specifics. Even if it's the same variety, it can be a different clone. We have about 6 or 7 clones of Pinot Noir. We have about 5 clones of Chardonnay, 2 clones of Pinot Meunier. I respect each of those blocks on its own. So it's a little bit like a painter. I get those panel of colors on my palette, and I can just throw that onto the canvas.
You sound like you're in Champagne, because, I mean, that's like, I think, not the secret, but, I mean, I think what people realize is Champagne's the art of blending. It's one of those rare things where it is that. I mean, when you finally, we were there 2 years ago with Laurent Perrier, and you, of course, that's a big house, but you walk through and you look at, what, 20-some million bottles worth and just in tank, and the ability to just blend and play and decide which Grand Cru you're going to mix with this and that and how much and what. And it's Champagne's, where Method Champenoise is about blending.
It's about blending. It's about
It's about farming too, to begin with.
Understanding a lot your vineyards, and as I said, each lot has its own particularities. That's the art of blending that makes those long lasting wines. We work with 3 varieties. We work with a specific wine, a base wine. We don't have the differences that you have with still wines, for example. If you want to blend all those different grapes that are quite different, because Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier, Chardonnay, they're very close family of grapes, although they're quite different in flavors. And that's what makes the house of sparkling what it is. It's that touch, that blend. And it's true for Champagne as well. It's that touch.
Can I ask you, because I have to, so this is your kind of regular...
It's if you want the
I mean
the
this is like a tête cuvée,
right?
This
that's the
one, RD. It's the one that's
right.
Takes the most work. It's sitting here. It's on Lee's.
I don't
want to
call
years.
It the crystal of the house, but we're
it's
not going to say that.
It's right. Tête cuvée. So this would cost me how much a bottle? 80, 90, 100?
No, we're still very modest on Long Island. We know that we haven't had that fame yet, so we stay around $70 in for that bottle. The other bottle that you have is what I would call the Brut Classic, Brut Premier for Roder, Brut Classic.
Right.
For Dutz, it's what I want people to know Sparkling Point for. This is a bottle that's a very good value for the quality. It's only $29. And in this one, you have all the attributes of the Method Champenoise. You have all the fabulous blend of Chardonnay and and Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier. But what I learned also on Long Island, we were talking about Long Island as a region, as a fantastic terroir, is that things that we cannot do otherwise. Like, for example, in California, Roder is not too much into making a Blanc de Blanc because the Chardonnay is more tropical flavors and all that. Where here on Long Island, we
you
are
don't have
more.
That
no, yeah. we have more the pear, the apple flavors. And you know, I discovered how to place that Blanc de Blanc into production and Blanc de Noir as well.
Guys, thanks so much for coming out. Gilles Martin, we're drinking the sparkling wine. You could tell who he was because he was the guy with the French accent. Mm-hmm. Alice Schaefer from Clouteau, thanks so much for coming out. Hopefully I get to see you guys again.
Yeah, come out and see us.
When we do our tour in September. But awesome. Really, really, really impressed. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Folks, that's it. I don't know who's on next week, but somebody, it'll be good, and it probably won't be wine the whole show either. It might be, but it probably won't be. See you next week. Take care. Thank you very much.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.